This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Dalziel Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
So, hi, I'm here today with Tom Scragg, and we're interviewing Dr. Elisabetta Valiente from the University of Cardiff. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
It's good to have you here, and it's Tom's first time interviewing, I believe.
Yes, first time, so could be a bit stuttery and horrible, but we'll see how we go.
Well, glad to have you here, and could you start off by just giving us a brief overview of what your research is about?
I work on extragalactic surveys, in particular with Herschel. Herschel is a European experiment that is not flying anymore, unfortunately, but we still have a lot of data to analyze. So I'm a member of Herschel Atlas, that is the biggest extragalactic survey, and we already did the first public data release last June, and we are working for the second data release. So what we observe are galaxies, in particular at high redshift, but also local galaxies, and to observe the galaxies with these instruments, they need to be dusty. So the dustier the galaxies here are, the more stars they form, and we're interested in these galaxies, forming galaxies, because it means they are very active, it means they are creating a lot of stars, they have a lot of energy, and we know that in the past galaxies formed more stars than we do today, so it's very interesting to look at how this star formation changed during the time, looking back in time.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about dusty galaxies, what do you mean by dust, and where does that come from?
Oh, this is a very big question. It is not exactly my topic of research, mm-hmm. but it's a big issue to understand where this dust comes from. It's formed by stars. So we know that in the stars start from hydrogen and they build heavier elements. So eventually we expect these elements to become heavier and heavier. And also particularly we expect these heavy elements that forms the dust to be formed in supernovae or AGB stars. Mm-hmm. So they are ejected like at the last stages of the life or AGB stars, or they are ejected the dust is ejected when a supernova explodes. Mm-hmm. But it's a topic, it's a very hot topic, and it's not very clear how dust forms and where it comes from, how much is from supernovae, how much is from stars, which, if it depends by the galaxy, if it depends from other kind of environments, nobody knows.
Oh, that's really great, because I always hear people talk about dust and never knew there was this mystery behind it. Yeah.
I was going to ask, you talk about dust. What's the difference then between dust and gas?
Well, the gas is lighter elements. So the gas is mainly composed by oxygen, carbon, or just hydrogen. Actually, we have molecular hydrogen, atomic hydrogen. This is the kind of gas we see in the universe. While when we talk about dust, it's actually dust. So they are heavy components. They are made by silicate, by chains of carbons. So they are more complex molecules. And they are very important in the star formation because they are very complex molecule. They help the gas to get together. So we know that to form stars is the gas that has to collapse. But where we have a big amount of dust, this collapse is easier. Just because, the different molecule of gas get attached to the molecule of dust, and it's easier to collapse them together and to start the gravitational growth that we need to form stars.
So it kind of clumps them together.
Yes.
Which seeds okay. The gravitational collapse.
So that's the reason why the dust is a proxy for star formation. So we measure the dust, and we can say, oh, we measure a lot of dust, we expect a lot of star formation for this galaxy. So for where you are lucky, you can measure independently amount of dust and amount of star formation. But once this thing has been done for a reasonable number of galaxies in different environment, we saw that the two things actually correlate. So now we just, for most of the galaxies, in particular the one at high redshift that are far away from us, so they're difficult to be detected. It's difficult for them to measure the amount of gas. We just measure the amount of dust. It is more easier, and we just derive from it the amount of gas and the star formation rate.
That makes sense.
Okay.
So what questions are you trying to answer with Herschel?
Is when most of the stars have been formed, and how is the activity of the galaxies changed? So how much energy the galaxies are emitting during their history? There was one press release, not made by Herschel, but made by another collaboration that is close to our HATAS collaboration. And the press release, the title was "The Universe is Dying." That it was a very fancy and catchy way to see that the universe in the past was much more active and energetic than it is now.
That does sound better. That's true. So in the past, galaxies were much more active. They were creating many, many more stars and that kind of thing. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And what's the reason for that?
Oh, well, that is another good question. Possibly because we had the biggest amount of gas that hasn't collapsed yet, so it was easier to collapse it together. And also because the universe was smaller. So because the universe was smaller, it was easier for the galaxy to interact together, so to merge and to have closer interactions. So it was much more likely. And when galaxies interact together, the gas get compressed and they form more stars. So once the universe has expanded enough, these interactions are less likely, and so it's more difficult to compress the gas and create a big amount of stars. But again, this is another big question, because, for example, there is a theory or a model that is called downsizing that tell us that is what we actually measure, that the biggest galaxies were at the top of their activities in the past, and now they look like dead, so they are not forming galaxies anymore, while now they are the smallest galaxies that are much more active, have the higher star formation rate. So why is this? It's not very clear. Mm-hmm. There are different cosmological models that try to display this, but it's not very clear why the bigger galaxies started to form a lot of stars before and they stopped, mm-hmm. and while the smaller galaxies are doing it now, because mm-hmm. now we observe high star formation rates in very small galaxies, in what we call dwarf galaxies. Mm-hmm. So it's a bigger question why activity was very strong in the past, and another bigger question is why it stopped. So we think that it stopped because at some point an AGN, an active galactic nucleus, formed in the center of the galaxy, mm-hmm. and so all the energy, all the very strong energy from this AGN, just destroyed the molecules of gas or warmed them up, because you get the best star formation when there is cold gas, because you need it to collapse together. If there is too much energy, if there is too much radiation, you don't get any star formation. So this mm-hmm. is one of the theories that try to explain why the star formation was so strong and then eventually stopped.
Mm-hmm. So this idea that at some point the active galactic nuclei are turned on to some extent, and they have an injection of heat and energy.
Yes.
Which prevents star formation. But then I guess that just passes on the question, because then the question is what caused the AGN?
It's probably just the galaxies assembling together. So I think the main very easy picture of this point of view is just at the beginning, there is just gas, and the gas starts to collapse following the gravitational field generated by the dark matter. So you start with dark matter that generates some gravitational field in some regions. Dark matter is denser than in other regions, so you have the gas falling into this dark matter gravity holes, and they start to collapse and form stars. When you have enough, we have to create a galaxy, the stars continue to fall in the center in the nucleus, and eventually they will collapse together and form a black hole. Now, of course, the process is not very clear, and probably what I'm saying, because it's not exactly my topic of research, is not 100% correct. Mm-hmm. But when the black hole is big enough, is energetic enough, it starts to emit in X-rays, and then it stops the star formation, and then it becomes a very powerful AGN. So we mm-hmm. expect a massive black hole in the mm-hmm. center of each galaxy. Not all of them become active. So we don't know, for example, we know that there is a galactic black hole in the center of our galaxy, but at the moment, fortunately, it is not active. We don't know if it's been active in the past or not.
Mm-hmm. But it might be one day, possibly. You never know.
I don't think it will become active, because our galaxy is not doesn't have such a strong star formation mm-hmm. rate that will activate the black hole. Mm-hmm. And probably we don't want it.
yeah, that's true. So going back to Herschel as well, because you've been quite involved with Herschel, Herschel Atlas. So what kind of challenges have there been in that project?
Well, Herschel Atlas is a very, very big survey, so I think the biggest challenge has been sociological, because there are a lot of people in the collaboration, and we have to agree all together, if not all of them, at least the core team has to agree with the major decisions. So it has been hard sometimes to get everybody in agreement with what we were doing, but we did it at the end, so it was good. It was nice to collaborate with so many people. It was nice to help so many people, because I was responsible for the catalogs and the data. So everybody writing papers on different topics. Eventually they came to me asking a recommendation or suggestions or some help in how to deal with the data, or about the properties of the noise and the properties and the uncertainties on fluxes of single sources. So it was very nice. And from the more practical point of view, I have to say that Herschel Spire, in particular, the instrument we have used for our survey, has been an amazing instrument. It worked way better than it was expected. Oh. So in principle, H-Atlas was supposed to be a very shallow survey that looked only in the close-by universe. But at the end, we did some high redshift science as well. So it was just a surprise. We didn't expect it at the beginning, but the data were good enough to do better than we expected.
Oh, that's always nice to have it that way around. So you mentioned before that you can use dust to trace star formation, and it's much easier to observe like how dusty a galaxy was than it can be sometimes to measure the star formation.
Yes.
Is that right? So what makes it easier to measure the dust than it is to look at the star formation?
Well, to measure the dust is a photometric measurement. So you just need a camera that measures the flux in even one, in the worst case, or two or three different wavelengths. So in our case, we have the Spire camera that measured the emission at 250, 350, and 500 micron, that just trace the peaks of the emission of the dust. We expect the dust to emit more or less as a black body. Depends if a galaxy is close by or far away, or it depends if a galaxy is cold or warm. The shape, the ratio between the flux in these three wavelengths will be slightly different, but more or less we expect to trace the peak of the dust emission. While for the gas is a spectroscopic measurement. So when you do spectroscopy, you need to measure very shallow lines. So you need different instruments that are more complicated to build than photometry instruments. And also you need to observe for longer time, because the signal is weaker, extended over a very short wavelength range. So it's usually just more expensive from any point of view. Then of course you can do it. You apply for telescope time, and you integrate for hours sometimes, and you can measure the lines, the molecular or atomic lines for the galaxy you are interested in, but you do it for one galaxy, so sometimes it takes a few hours for each galaxy. While when you do photometry, you just observe a big patch of the sky and you measure thousands of galaxies in it, and you have the fluxes in three bands with just one scan for several galaxies. So it's much easier and cheaper.
Get more galaxies. And you said you've been involved with compiling the catalogue for Herschel.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not an observational astronomer at all. What does that involve? Because I have no idea.
Well, you have what is called the timeline data from the instrument. So it means that for each bolometer, you know what. A camera is made by different bolometers that are the detectors of the instrument, and for each bolometer you have the information at each time, what is the position it's looking at, and which is the flux that it's measuring.
Okay.
So you get you have several bolometers. Actually, I can't say, there are maybe tens, if not hundreds, of bolometers in the Spire camera. I'm not sure what is the number, but you put together this information from all the bolometers and you build a map.
Okay.
So in the map, you have each pixel in the maps is one position, and all the informations given by different bolometer about that position are averaged together. So in this way, you have independent information, independent measurements of the flux in that specific point, and you put together all the pixels in your map, and you have information of the flux in small or large, depending how big your survey is, a patch of the sky. And then once you have your map, you usually also know the uncertainty with each pixel. And then you look for peaks in the signal to noise map. So in this map, there will be intrinsic noise. So there will be fluctuations that is just noise. When you see a positive fluctuation that is like two, three, four, or five sigma, five times the average fluctuations, you may assume that it's very unlikely that that fluctuation is just noise, but it will probably be a source. So you just select peaks of the noise. If you select three sigma or five sigma fluctuations, so you are sure that you only, for example, 0.1% of your sources are fake sources, are just fluctuation of the noise, but all the rest will be real sources.
So you have to go through and pick out the sources and...
Well, there are codes that
Do so this. It's not a manual thing.
No.
Yeah, I ask.
We passed that point.
In some fields it is, so I always ask. I think that was something that surprised me in astronomy, is how many things are done manually. So I always
very
ask.
Hard work.
It's a computational thing. There are codes look for peaks, and they're also able... depending who wrote the code, but they're also able to understand if they are reliable peaks or not, because of course you know which is the transfer function of the instrument. So what you have in the sky is a single point source, but what you have in your map is like a round patch. And this depends on the fact that the instrument has a transfer function. So what is a very, very sharp peak, a delta, will become something that is more that is more spread. It's like a Gaussian shape.
Smears it out, actually.
Yes, but we know what is the transfer function of the instrument. It's called point spread function. So what we look in the map is for things that have the same shape of the point spread function of the instrument. If something has a weird shape, it's very, very spiky, maybe it's just a glitch in the electronics, a glitch and some unexpected noise, but it's likely not a source.
So we've talked a little bit about what you have been working on. What are you looking forward to over the next few years, whether it's in your own work or in the field in general, or for, you know, Herschel data?
Well, regarding Herschel data, regarding the project, we are working for a second data release. So the field we observed was very, very large. There were actually different fields. So we did a public release last summer for one third of the area we observed, and we plan to, by the summer, a second data release with the rest of the data. And of course, I'm also working to do science on this data. So I'm working on the number counts, on the AGN content on these galaxies, on the clustering on these galaxies. So I have several projects me on, or the students that I follow are working on. For the future, we'll think to cross-correlate this data with surveys that will come. So there is SKA that will cover large portions of the sky in the radio, and so we will use the information we already have about from the far infrared, and we cross-correlate with radio sources, and it will be interesting to see what comes from.
What kind of thing could you expect to learn from that, from the cross-correlation, from looking at the two surveys?
Well, we expect the sources to emit, the star-forming galaxies to emit in the radio as well. There is actually a correlation, a very tight correlation between the far infrared and radio, just because the we have the emission from the dust is at the far infrared, but the stars, the very young stars that just formed, they emit in the radio because of a synchrotron emission. So they are very tightly correlated because they are mapping the same physical phenomenon, that is a very young star where you have star formation. So on one side, we measure the amount of dust that helps the gas to collapse. On the other side, we measure the signal that comes from the stars, the very big stars that just formed. So there is a very tight correlation, but having until now it was harder to get radio measurement from large patch of sky. So we usually have measurements on single object, or there are radio surveys, but they're not so big. But having something like SKA that is be able to do survey on a large area, it might be survey to compare with, given that Herschel Atlas is the largest extragalactic survey made with Herschel, so it's the largest map we have in the far infrared. One problem when you look at the sky is that if you look at a patch of sky that is too small, you have what is called cosmic variance. So you might measure something, you might think you might learn something about the universe, but you are only looking at a very small patch. So maybe you are measuring, again, a fluctuation. Maybe you are measuring something very, very peculiar. It's like if you look at the human body, you know, and you only look at the nail, you might think that we are covered like something very hard like nails. Mm-hmm. But it's just because you are looking a very small patch and you've been lucky mm-hmm. because you picked a point that is not very characteristic.
That's a good analogy.
It's good to observe large areas mm-hmm. because you get a good idea of what really is how really is the universe on average. And you mm-hmm. can also measure if there are specific things that change on mm-hmm. small or large scale. Just because you have such a large area, you can see how the properties fluctuate. Mm-hmm. And you also can discover very rare objects mm-hmm. because if an object is rare, there are not so, by definition, yeah. there are not so many of them. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you look at a very small patch of the sky, it's mm-hmm. very unlikely you find it. So looking in a very large portion of the sky is important from this point of view, both to understand how the universe works mm-hmm. on average, just having the problem of the cosmic variance, and mm-hmm. it's possible to find a very extreme or very rare or very mm-hmm. weird objects that are very difficult to find.
Mm-hmm. Weird is always good in astronomy, I think.
Can I just ask, how long does the survey take actually on Herschel? So how long are you collecting data? And then how long does it take you to analyze that data to get to the...
I can say how long it took to analyze the data. I can't tell how many hours. I should look at the proposal. I cannot tell how many hours observation time it has been. We observed 600 square degrees. Mm-hmm. And, well, it was a first release. It was just a few months after the observations. So the first portion of the sky, it was 4x4 square degrees. It was released quite soon. But then, because we wanted to do a very good job, probably even too much, we spent 4 more years to do this data release with 1/3 of the data. Well, I have to say, what we've learned in these 4 years, it will be applied also to the other 2/3. So we are not spending 2 times more time to release the other maps. Mm-hmm. But there was so much to analyze and understand mm-hmm. about the properties of the noise, about to be sure that the tools we were using, like mm-hmm. the code to extract the sources, was really working and was doing what we expected to do. So mm-hmm. when you do this kind of job, you have to run a lot of simulations. So it's not only doing the job once, like extracting the sources and measure the flux. You have to do this job a lot of times on different synthetic maps to be sure that you are doing what you think you are doing and not something else. Because, as you know, probably very even better than me, when you write a code, it's not always true that it does what you want it to do.
No, I think that's a great point, because I think people often think, you know, once you get your telescope and you get an image straight away and you can just go do science, and they kind of forget there's all this processing between and checking that works and, yeah, all the work that goes into it.
And every instrument's unique, and the way it behaves is different from everyone else.
Yeah, with every instrument, it's always like starting from scratch, because, you must tune your codes, you must tune everything for the specifics of the instruments. That's why it's so important to work closer with people that built the instruments or calibrate the instruments mm-hmm. or wrote the code, all the codes for the instruments mm-hmm. to understand better what's going on.
Mm. So thank you very much for coming on the Dreadcast, and hopefully we'll have you on again sometime in the future.
I hope so. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for inviting me.